few paragraphs of this sound familiar, it's because I used them in a November service on ancestry. Ever see a baby being born? If you haven't, try watching Call the Midwife on PBS. Seeing the little creatures get pushed out of their warm cocoons into the cold, hard universe evokes deep emotions inside us, wakes our parental instincts up from their primordial slumber, makes us want to hug the little beings, even hold them and put our lips on their foreheads and cheeks. And if one has never watched children be born, the same sort of reaction can still take over our bodies and souls anytime we see a tiny child for the first time, or for that matter, at the first sighting of a newborn kitten or puppy. When those little eyes look up at us, unexpected emotions are likely to crowd up out of nowhere, hit us hard, whammo, and make us have feelings many of us could never have imagined before. And we are likely to keep on having those feelings and wanting to provide nurture for the rest of our lives. What is most special about the emotions we might feel at those moments is that they are not self-centered. Rather, they are other-centered. They are triggered by seeing the vulnerability of another being. They bring out of us a strong instinct, the instinct to protect and sustain someone other than ourselves. We could refer to these emotions as the other-centered end of the love spectrum, or simply as the urge to nurture, or urge to nurture. So if this is the purest, most other-centered human emotion, what is at the other end of the continuum? What is the most self-centered human emotion? My initial response was to think that it is the emotion that hits us so hard during adolescence, physical desire. But upon considerable reflection, I now see that the most self-centered human emotion is the one the newborn baby is experiencing. Its survival is at stake. A bond is created with the mother who cradled it inside her body, and whatever person or persons that nourish and nurse and nurture it after its emergence into the world. We could refer to this emotion as the urge for nurture. I suspect, but of course cannot prove, that deep in our subconscious mind is the primal memory of when we ourselves came out of the womb and into the cold world. When we see that tiny baby looking up at us, we identify with this vulnerability. That unconscious memory of our own birth heightens that identification. We are providing the baby with the kind of nurturance we once so deeply needed. And in touching the baby, we also are satisfying our own ongoing need for connection. Now, these two ends of the love spectrum do not exist just at times of birth and parenthood. Rather, they exist in us always in various combinations and permutations. In relationships with a partner, we are likely to experience them in relatively equal measure. Each of us gives and receives nurture. Each of us gives and receives connectedness. Each of us gives and needs and receives security. So if this is what love is all about, where then does physical desire fit in? In the movies I saw when I was growing up, two people would fall in love and then, maybe 5 minutes later, hop into bed together just as the camera fades to fireworks in the distance. Fortunately, the movies of today as a whole are a bit less blatant, but not totally so. The sex ed classes I attended at my Unitarian church in the 1960s taught me a lot about male and female anatomy, but almost nothing about how these relate to the human heart. And how was it that only after the anatomical and hormonal changes of adolescence that I and others developed terrible crushes? Was love really all about sex? I was massively confused. Literature wasn't much help either. So many great writers I read became famous initially by writing something with sexual overtones. Nathaniel Hawthorne, adultery. Herman Melville, nudity on Polynesian islands. Walt Whitman and William Faulkner, endless sexual references. James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence, famous only after their books were banned. The list goes on and on. The reading public noticed what great writers they were only after sensuality made their works into bestsellers. To make matters worse, the English language, both then and now, does a horrible job of differentiating between love and desire. A music lover is a person who loves music. An art lover is a person who loves art, and so on. But the word lover, all by itself, has come to mean someone with whom we are having a sexual relationship, usually secretive. And we make love whether or not love is there. What I've come to believe here in my old age is that desire is not love and is also not the opposite of love. Rather, physical desire is simply a craving for the sharing of a certain kind of pleasure with another being, and is part of our identity as human beings, as is our gender preference. When we don't know these aspects of our identity, we may need to explore, even though that exploration can sometimes result in pain for both our partners and ourselves, especially when we are not careful. Love and desire often work very well together in a relationship. Each of them can sometimes even help jumpstart the other. But sometimes in our over-eagerness for pleasure, we end up hurting everybody concerned and even defeat our own best interests. What is so tricky is that we have here yet another emotion that hits us, whammo, without any warning. And we can all too quickly plunge into a relationship without ever really knowing for sure how much of it is because of love and how much of it is because of physical desire. What does it take to foresee those times when following our desire will likely have good results for all concerned and when it will end up hurting others and even ourselves? Many years ago, I opened an old volume inherited from my Scottish-born grandfather, The Poems and Songs of Robert Burns. I knew that Burns was famous for writing some of the supposedly most heartfelt love poems ever written, and also some of the most sensual. By chance, I opened to a poem about, you guessed it, the joys of coupling in a field of barley with someone with whom you are in love. In this case, a woman named Annie. Actually, it was comparing cornfields and barley fields as to which was a better place for this purpose. Anyway, my mind was immediately filled with images of rural Scottish landscapes, bathed in misty moonlight, with lusty young couples here and there locked in passionate embrace. This is why they did it, I thought. This is why all 2,000 of my ancestors alive back then did it. In an age of brief life expectancy, poverty, and hardship, this was their dream of transcendence. But if this was their dream, what was the reality? I read the rest of the Burns poems and then the introduction and chronology, and discovered that Burns had conceived at least 13 children by at least 5 different women, that he may have been an alcoholic, that 3 of the women sued him for child support, that he proposed to 3 of the women and 1 of them accepted and bore him 9 of his last 10 children, and that he himself died at the early age of 37, at least partially as the result of overworking himself on his dirt farm to support all those kids. What a strange collision of dream and reality. The more reality caught up with him, the more he ran off to the barley fields to sow his oats. And the more he ran off to the barley fields, the more reality caught up with him in the form of more children he could not support, along with more hurt and angry women. It would be awfully easy to pass judgment on Burns and his partners, as many in his generation did, and as many in our generation today probably would, those bodies which met up with other bodies in the barley fields and will come in through the rye. But I suspect that if we could talk with Barbie Burns, we would learn that he, like so many in our own generations, was never exactly sure where desire ends and love begins. He may have thought he knew, or he may simply have been too much of a romantic to have realized that being overly eager to express physical desire can often defeat everyone's best interests. Let's imagine Robert Burns growing up in a late 20th or early 21st century Unitarian Universalist congregation and going through the Our Whole Lives program. Instead of thinking about whether to use a barley field or a cornfield for that evening's liaison and being in so much of a hurry to get there, he might have thought about such things as, say, transcending mystery and wonder, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Perhaps he might even have imagined himself looking down from the stars at what he was about to do and saying to himself, "Yes, this is beautiful and sure might feel good, but will the end result be more joy or more pain and hardship for both my partner and me?" Of course, had he been less active and verbal concerning his physical passions, he might not have become Scotland's most widely read poet. But at the same time, he might then have lived long enough to write tomes about how to know just what might actually be a good time to visit a barley field and what might not. While he may have left fewer descendants that way, each child would have been able to spend more time in loving relationship with a father. Maybe he'd even have had time to teach his kids how to write great poetry. What is significant is that both love and desire often invade us unbidden and at inconvenient times. This is because we are pre-programmed to be smitten by them. We're pre-programmed because we would not be here if most of our ancestors had not been overcome in some way. And guess what? We have inherited our ancestors' DNA. What we need, I believe, is greater capacity for empathy and also for intuition and spirituality. We need to be able to look into a person's eyes and take a few moments to imagine what will likely happen to that person and to us if we follow our passion. May we stop and reflect for a few minutes on love, on all the love our ancestors bestowed on each other and on their children, and on the love shared by all the people we know. May we also remember the emotions we felt upon seeing those little eyes looking up at us, emotions that more often than not had happy endings for everyone involved. And may we reflect for a few minutes on desire, on all our ancestors' physical attractions, and on the physical attractions of people of our own generations, attractions that sometimes had happy endings and sometimes tragic ones. May we acknowledge that it's not easy being alive on this planet. It's not easy navigating life when both love and desire are so ready to take over our bodies and souls. May we learn to forgive ourselves for all the ways in which we are so terribly and so wonderfully human. And may we know that in our conflicts and confusions, we are never alone. And finally, if what burned inside Bobby Burns should happen to burn inside any of us, as I suspect it burns to a greater or lesser extent in many of us simply because we are human, before our flame sets fire to any more barley fields, may we take a few moments to let some little eyes look up at us and remind us of what love feels like when it's not tinged with desire. And maybe, too, we could remember these words from the Rumi poem we heard earlier in today's service. All your unfulfilled desires are from your greed for gain of fulfillments. Let go of them all, and they will be sent as gifts. Amen, amen, namaste. May it be so.